Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello there, I'm Liam Neeson. I don't know who you are, I don't know what you want, but if you're not listening to the Court Case Podcast, I will come looking for you. I will find you. And I will make you listen to it.
Hello and welcome to the Court Case Podcast with me, your host, James Court.
And me, your co-host, Sweet Tea.
It's 2023 and we're back with some new episodes for you. Today, we're going to be diving into Charles Manson and his cult, the Manson family, the murders, the mystery, the conspiracy. It's all coming right after this.
Man, Charlie's going to dig you.
Welcome back, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in to our first episode of 2023. You know, it's been a bit of a while.
It's been a minute.
Yeah, it's been around 2 months or so, but a lot has been happening. We've had a lot of life changes. And so, you know, we had to take a bit of a step back. We had to take a bit of a break.
Gosh, have we got so much to tell.
I know. Obviously, we went on holiday over... Well, not obviously.
I was going to say, it's not obvious.
We went on holiday over Christmas and we had another short trip away in January. We went to Krakow and then we went to Belfast.
For the night, yeah.
Yep. We had Christmas. My family moved out of their home. So that was all a bit of a blur, a bit of a wish-wash.
And then after Boxing Day, we have a new little member of our family here in Brighton.
The most important news, yeah, we have just after Boxing Day we adopted a little dog. He's called Chewie. I named him, short for Chewbacca from Star Wars.
So what's your name anyway? Chewbacca. All right, well, you're going to need a nickname because I ain't saying that every time.
He was called SID before. Can't say it as he sat next to me and we trained him to have a new name.
Sid. His name was Sid.
Oh, his ears went.
Did it? Oh, God. Well, he's taken to the new name pretty well. Well, I mean, he answers to the new name now.
Oh, Chewie.
So, there's his name, little Chewie. Yeah, he's a little Jack Russell.
He is the best dog. We got so bloody lucky. It's ridiculous.
We have. He's 5 years old. He's already basically trained. He's, you know, had all of his injections, all of that. We've gotten some vet insurance. We've sorted him right out. He's cute. He loves people. The only problem is that he doesn't like dogs. He's a very big dog racist. He hates them.
Yeah. He bloody goes for them, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Even the big ones. He's quite small, you know. Mm-hmm. But he will go for any size dogs. The only dog that he hasn't gone for is a Great Dane, which understandably no one would even try and go for a Great Dane.
He approached a Great Dane the other day and I was like,
and he backed away. Give it a go.
You're not taking
it. It is funny watching him mouth off at a big dog and you just think, you don't stand a chance, Chewie. You don't stand a bloody chance.
It's so funny.
Bless him. He gives it a good go.
Yeah, but we've loved having him around. He's a beautiful addition to the to the Court Case family.
Yeah.
And you know what people are like as soon as they get pets. There's pictures everywhere. So I'm sure you'll see some pictures of him on the social media from time to time.
Mascot. He is our mascot. I was about to say he's the Court Case mascot. Go on, Chewie. You've got two roles, mate.
Yeah, we'll have to ask for his verdict at the end of this episode.
You're going to give us your verdict? Don't know what that word means.
We've got some cool episodes coming up, well, in my mind, in the series. Obviously, today is going to be one of those episodes where I've put a buttload of research in and we're going to be talking about one particular topic. We've got an interview with a man called Thomas Duncan Bell, already recorded, coming up. He's a guy that he went to Ukraine during the war and helped bring kids out. Very fascinating.
Yeah, we did record this a while ago now.
Yes, we did, but we've been holding on to it and just waiting for a good time to release it, and we figured it'd be a good collab to start the season with, so that'll be coming out
soon.
Yeah,
at least you've got some backlogged episodes now.
Yes, yeah, and I wanted to do an episode where we do sort of an old school, where T brings some gossip that she's got, and we do some courting with James, so... Yeah. Get ready for one of those, a classic court case coming up in a couple of weeks. But today we're going to do one particular topic, fascinating one like the DB Cooper and like the Alcatraz episode. I've put in a lot of research. I've done 15 pages of research for this particular topic.
So strap in, basically.
So strap in. Now, the reason that I picked this one is, one, I watched Once Upon a Time in Hollywood again the other day. I thought it was fantastic. I love that film. One of the first films I went and saw with you.
Yeah, and believe it was the first film movie we watched together.
Yeah, it might have been. And you enjoyed it, from what I recall.
Yeah, I loved it, yeah.
It was really good.
Probably would never have watched it, if I'm honest.
Yeah. And obviously they cover a huge part of the Hollywood history. They cover the Manson murders, and although they put a different spin on it.
Is everybody okay?
Well, the fucking hippies aren't. That's for goddamn sure.
Which I think was good. And but also, he appeared in the news recently. A few days ago, I saw a article that came up that said, who will be named Charles Manson's heir? A judge is set to rule this week on who gets his apparently $1 million estate. I don't know.
Ooh, I want that.
I don't know. If you'd look at his history, which we will delve into, I don't know how he's got $100 million saved up. I mean, he's dead now, but I don't know how he's got $1 million estate. But I think it's part of the rights to his music and stuff, because he was a musician. He wrote music. We'll be listening to a clip of one of his songs later on.
Interesting.
But yeah, so apparently there's two people that are claiming they're Charles Manson's grandson, and
of course they
and
are.
They are fighting over his will.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting part of the news, but that's not the most interesting bit that we're going to get into. So T,
James,
had you heard of Charles Manson before you saw?
No, I hadn't. I've never heard of him before. We watched that movie. No.
Yeah. And since watching the movie, have you learned any more, or do you not know?
I've learned the odd bit from stuff that you've said, but I've not like decided to use my time to do some research.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, you're going to be bombarded with info today.
What am I going to do with that type of information? Tell some passengers on my flight.
Yeah, you could do.
Yeah.
You could do that.
But like, I know you want a tea, but let me tell you about Charles Manson, all right?
I find it, Charles Manson in particular, I find fascinating, particularly the murders that were covered in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Tate, LaBianca murders, because I really find old school Hollywood fascinating. Like I said to you the other day, that I'd like to go back to Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And these murders in particular were classed by many as like the end of old school Hollywood. Like when these murders happened, a lot of people mark that as the end of the 60s and the end of old school Hollywood. Like it died with that.
That can all change like that.
Which is fascinating. I didn't realize how gruesome those murders are. Obviously, in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, it's completely different.
Mm.
What actually happened to them, when I've read up on it, is disgusting. Mm. And you're going to find out.
Okay.
But let's just dive straight into it. We'll start with a little bit of his biography. So Charles Manson himself, he was born November 12th, 1934. His mother was 15 years old when she had him.
15?
Yeah, so a little whippersnapper. And it says that Manson may never have known his biological father.
Okay.
Many people contribute a lack of a father to, you know...
Issues.
Yeah, issues. A lot of criminals have... I want some of my drink, actually. A lot of criminals class that as, you know, a key point in why they...
I guess they could say that about a lack of mother as well, like a lack of childhood and upbringing and parents. Like, yeah. It's the same.
I don't think it is... I think a two-parent household is so important to the upbringing of a child. I don't think, obviously, I give huge props to single mothers and single fathers out there doing what they can. But I think a healthy two-parent household is so important, I think, to a child's upbringing.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. But anyway, so his first crimes. So Manson said that when he was 9 years old, he set his school on fire.
Jesus, how?
I don't know. That's all I've got on that. But he started young, clearly.
Bloody hell.
And he also, when he was young, he committed 2 armed robberies as well. Yeah. So he was sent to a strict reform school. So that's kind of like It's kind of like a boarding school, but for like delinquents, like criminal kids. And apparently there, he was allegedly raped by some of the students with the encouragement of a staff member.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, I know. And while at school, Manson developed a self-defense technique that he called the insane game, where if he was unable to defend himself, he would screech, grimace, and wave his arms to convince aggressors that he was literally insane.
What?
So if these kids, for example, were gear like coming up to beat him up or rape him, he would just like flail his arms around and make weird noises and screech and stuff, so they'd be like, whoa, this guy's crazy, and back off.
Right, okay. Well, I mean, if it works, it works.
Yeah. He escaped from school in 1951, and he was then arrested in Utah for stealing cars.
Right.
Now, after this arrest, this was when the beginnings of the Manson family, as the cult was called, started to come about. Now, the Manson family is his cult, like his group of followers, and they were a commune, a gang, and a cult, and they were known by its members and many others as the family.
Right.
And it was active in California in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Do you know much about cults?
The odd bit.
Yeah, so cults are basically
just stay away from them.
Yeah, they're basically just very extreme sort of religions where they worship like normally one person in particular. They control its members. It's very like hypnotic and addictive.
Yeah,
and people never normally leave like cults and stuff like that. It's very dangerous.
It's like a lifestyle.
Yeah, sort of. Very bad lifestyle. Yeah. You watched that Netflix show once, I think, where there was that detective that, like, investigated the cult. Yeah, like that.
Yeah.
Like that. So, the group consisted of around 100 followers. They lived an unconventional lifestyle and frequently used psychoactive drugs like amphetamine and hallucinogens such as LSD.
Right.
Now, what's interesting is most of the followers were young women from middle-class backgrounds, many of whom were attracted by hippie culture and communal living and then radicalized by Manson's teachings. So I don't know if you remember, because it's been a while since you saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but do you remember when Brad Pitt's character goes to that ranch and there's all those women there and they're all like hippie-looking women?
No.
You don't remember that?
No. You know me. I don't remember much that happens in movies or TV shows ever.
Okay. Well, moving on then. But yeah, so his followers were mostly young women, basically.
Right.
And they liked the hippie culture and communal living. And he began attracting followers in San Francisco in 1967. And they gradually moved to a rundown ranch called the Spawn Ranch in Los Angeles County. That was what I was talking about in the film. Brad Pitt's character, the stuntman, he goes to Spawn Ranch where Charles Manson's followers all live. And it was basically what it was this movie ranch where they used to film westerns on.
Right.
But they didn't anymore. And basically Charles Manson's followers just went and took over the place and just started living there on this little ranch.
Oh, okay.
The ranch burned down in a Southern California wildfire in September 1970. That's after all the killings and stuff, but just a bit of info there. According to group member Susan Atkins, the members of the family became convinced that Charles Manson was a manifestation of Jesus Christ and believed in his prophecies concerning an imminent apocalyptic race war.
Race war, right.
So war of the races. Yeah. Like black against white, against Asian, against whatever. That's what they were taught by Charles Manson and convinced.
Mm-hmm.
In 1969, family members Susan Watkins, Tex Watson, and Patricia Krenwinkel entered the home I know, sorry. Stupid name. Entered the home of Hollywood actress Sharon Tate and murdered her and four others.
Oh, crikey.
Which obviously that's the part that you know again, mm-hmm. know about. Linda Kasabian was also present but did not take part. And members of the Manson family also committed a number of other murders, assaults, petty crimes and thefts. We're going to go into all of those soon, but I wanted to do a more sort of cohesive timeline of the events for you.
Okay.
So it starts with his San Francisco followers. So he hasn't moved to Spawn Ranch in California yet. He's still in San Francisco. So he started by living mostly by begging in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And then Manson became acquainted with a woman called Mary Brunner, who was 23 years old, and she was a graduate of the University of Wisconsin. And then Manson soon moved in with her. Now, when they started moving in, it was just them two. But then Manson started trying to convince her to let other women stay in the house.
Right.
And she was resistant at first, but then he eventually overcame this resistance to bring in other women to live with them.
Mm-hmm.
And before long, they were sharing her apartment with 18 other women. This is what I don't get what it was about this guy, but he was just a babe magnet. And just women were just like,
I can't remember. Was he like fit? Would he be classed as a fit guy?
I personally don't. Attractive person? I've looked up pictures of him.
Please get up a picture of
him.
I
personally don't think he is fit.
Well,
but if we search,
let me have a say.
Charles Manson, 1960. So we can get him when he was attracting the
what
women.
He was, yeah, what he would look like at that time.
Like, that's what he looked like.
Oh, goddy gosh. No.
That was obviously his mugshot.
Oh, no.
But, like, yeah, exactly what I thought. Oh, that was interesting. Bryan Cranston,
yeah.
The guy that plays, obviously, Walter White,
yeah.
He met Charles Manson. He was like 12. Bryan Cranston was like 12
gosh.
Years old.
Oh, okay.
And the main income at Spawn Ranch when it stopped being a ranch was horseback riding.
Right.
And him and his family used to go on holidays and they went horseback riding there.
No.
And he was coming back from the horseback riding once and there was a big group of girls that was like, Charlie's back, Charlie's back. And he saw Charles Manson.
Oh, that's so weird.
Yeah, I know. Very surreal. But yeah, okay. So he's not fit.
No,
but,
he's not at all.
But yeah, he was a babe magnet. And
was it because he had money, I bet?
No, he didn't. He was begging in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah, true.
Well, I don't get it. But basically, not only that, he had this one woman that he was living with, and he was apparently so attractive that it was the woman's apartment. She's like, yeah, bring 18 other women to come and live with
us.
Yeah,
I'm trying to figure what it could be then.
I don't know. But Manson established himself as a guru in San Francisco's Haight Ashbury district, which during the 1967 Summer of Love was emerging as a signature hippie locale. So basically, hippie culture was huge in the 1960s, and 1967 was labelled like the Summer of Love, and it was when hippie stuff was at its height.
Maybe he was a very charismatic, friendly guy, and it's the personality that got him.
He really
got him hooked.
Manson allegedly taught his followers that they were the reincarnation of the original Christians. So that's what
right,
he said to
okay.
him. Before the end of the summer, Manson and some of the women began traveling in an old school bus they had adapted, putting coloured rugs and pillows in the place of the many seats they had removed. So they're like, yeah, so this ugly man, let's go get in a school bus with him and it's going to be
so strange.
Really cool and sexy. Why not? They eventually settled in the Los Angeles areas of Topanga Canyon, Malibu and Venice along the coast.
Oh, lovely.
Manson had a dynamic personality. He was able to read a person's emotional weaknesses and manipulate them, apparently. So that sounds very narcissistic, doesn't it? So I guess that that must be how he did it. He must have been able to just manipulate them. This is very interesting. Are you aware of, you probably don't listen to them, but the band The Beach Boys?
I've heard of The Beach Boys, yeah.
Songs, yeah, you know, I'm picking up the good vibrations.
Oh, I didn't know they sang that. Yeah, yeah, but yeah. I do.
So Dennis Wilson of The Beach Boys unknowingly picked up two Manson family members, Patricia Krenwinkel, the funny name one, and Ella Jo Bailey, when they were hitchhiking in late spring of 1968, while under the influence of alcohol and LSD. He took them to his house for a few hours. So I think he was just driving around. He was a bit drunk. And he was just like, you know, two girls, come back to my house. So he brings them back. And the following morning, the Beach Boy guy, Dennis Wilson, returned home and Charles Manson was just at his house, just like at the doorstep. And he emerged from his house and Dennis Wilson asked the stranger, Manson, if he was there to hurt him. And Manson assured him that he had no such intention and began to kiss his feet.
Oh, okay.
And I heard that, T.
Sorry, I was just trying to post the photo of you on the socials.
Got it. Right. We'll do that in a bit.
I like to multitask, don't I?
I know, sweetheart.
I'm really sorry. It's a bad habit of mine.
But yeah, so Dennis Wilson, this Beach Boy guy, he comes home and he sees Manson stood at the doorstep and he's like, you know, what the hell are you doing here? And Manson's like, I'm not here to hurt you. He starts kissing his feet.
Jesus.
And then when Wilson went into his house, he discovered 12 strangers in there, mostly women.
Right.
And over the next few months, the number of women doubled in the Beach Boys' house. He covered their cost, which amounted to around $100,000. This included a large medical bill for the treatment of their gonorrhea. Wilson would sing and talk with Manson, and they both treated the women as servants. Wilson paid for studio time to record songs written and performed by Manson, and he introduced Charles Manson to entertainment business acquaintances. Wilson moved out of his rented home when the lease expired and the landlord evicted the family. Now, I'm going to play you a little clip of one of Charles Manson's songs.
Do it.
Just enough that we don't get copyright claimed.
Yeah.
But this is what he sounded like.
There's a time for living.
Oh.
I know.
He actually has a nice voice.
Keeps on flying.
I would have listened to that.
I would have listened to that. That's quite good, to be fair, which is very annoying.
Very annoying.
I think what happened? He could have used that talent for good, couldn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And he's wasted.
He actually could have been rich and wouldn't be begging. Yeah.
So, next bit of the timeline. He's gone from San Francisco to the Beach Boys' house. Now, Spawn Ranch. Manson established a base for the family at Spawn Ranch in August 1968 after Wilson's landlord evicted them. It had been a TV and movie set for westerns, but the buildings had deteriorated by the late 1960s, which is, you know, what I told you. At this point, the ranches mainly got revenue from selling horseback rides, which is obviously what Brian Cranston was up to.
Formerly known in the UK as just horse riding.
Yes, I don't know why they call it horseback riding. But that's what they do. Female family members did chores around the ranch and occasionally had sex on Manson's orders with the nearly blind 80-year-old owner, George Spawn. The women also acted as guides for him. In exchange, Spawn allowed Manson and his group to live at the ranch for free.
Hey, does George Spawn still own this ranch?
Well, we take care of George. We love George.
So Spawn was like the landlord of the ranch.
Right.
Manson moves in. He's got all these women. He's like, look, can we stay at the ranch for free? And Spawn's like, all right. And Manson's like, I'll let you
know.
Yeah,
he's got the run of the land.
Yeah.
Decisions go through him.
Yep. And this brings us to his encounter with Sharon Tate.
Sharon Tate.
This is his...
Gorgeous woman.
Yep. This is his first and only encounter with her before the murders. So on March 23rd, 1969, Charles Manson entered the grounds of 10050 Cielo Drive, which he had known as Melcher's residence. Now, Terry Melcher was a record producer that had associated with the Manson family. He's one of the record producers that the Beach Boy guys would have introduced Charles Manson to.
I see the connection.
But Manson was not invited to the house. He just turned up there. And as he approached the main house, Manson was met by a guy called Shakrock Hatemi, an Iranian photographer. He had befriended Polanski and Tate during the making of the documentary Mia and Roman, and he was there to photograph Sharon Tate before she departed for Rome the next day. Now, obviously, Terry Melcher lived in this house first as record producer, and then famous director Roman Polanski, who was married to Sharon Tate, they live in the house now.
Right.
I think they rent it. I don't think they own it. Once this photographer saw Manson approach, Hatemi had gone into the front porch to ask him what he wanted. Manson said that he was looking for someone whose name Hatemi did not recognize. Hatemi told him the place was the Polanski residence. Sharon Tate appeared behind Hatami in the house's front door and asked him who was calling. A minute or two later, he left. That evening, Manson returned to the property and went to the guest house. He entered the porch and spoke with Altobelli, the owner, who had just come out of the shower. Manson asked for Terry Melcher, but Altobelli felt that Manson was looking for him. Altobelli told Manson through the screen door that Melcher had moved to Malibu and that he did not know his new address, although he actually did. He was just being protective.
Right.
Altobelli told Manson he was leaving the country the next day, and Manson said he would like to speak with him upon his return. Altobelli and Sharon Tate flew together to Rome the next day. Sharon Tate asked him whether that creepy looking guy had gone to see him at the guest house the day before. And that was that encounter. Now, the next crime involving the Manson family, chronologically, was called the Crow Shooting. Now, Tex Watson, a main male member of the Manson family.
Oh, and here's someone you absolutely have to meet. One of our most favorite sons. Tex, come on over here and say hi to Cliff.
Became involved in drug dealing and robbed a drug dealer named Bernard Crow. Crow allegedly responded with a threat to kill everyone at Spawn Ranch. In response, Charles Manson shot Crow on July the 1st, 1969 at Manson's Hollywood apartment. Manson believed that Crow was a member of the Black Panthers, although he wasn't. Do you know what the Black Panthers are? No, that's the Pink Panther.
Oh. There's two. God. There's black and pink.
So, obviously...
I didn't know there was a black and pink one.
So, obviously, there's Black Panther, who's the superhero, and there's the
Pink Panther. Oh, Black Panther. Fuck me, of course.
But in the 60s, there was a group called the Black Panthers, and they were like a very... pro-black people.
Why is it such a popular name?
I don't know. But right. Basically, because Crow was black, Charles Manson believed that Crow was a member of the Black Panthers.
Right.
And so Charles Manson expected a retaliation for shooting him. So he turned Spawn Ranch into a defensive camp, establishing night patrols by armed guards. Tex Watson would later write, "Blackies are trying to get at the chosen ones." Which is a bit... bit racist and just, a bit strange.
Just a bit, yeah.
You think they're the chosen ones. So the next crime was the Hinman murder. Gary Allen Hinman was a music teacher. At some point in the late 1960s, he befriended members of the Manson family, allowing some to occasionally stay at his home. According to some people, including family member Susan Atkins, Manson believed that Hinman was wealthy. He sent family members Bobby Boussoleil, Mary Brunner and Susan Atkins to Hinman's home on July 25th, 1969, to convince him to join the family and turn over the assets Manson thought that Hinman had inherited. The three held Hinman hostage for 2 days as he denied having any money. During this time, Charles Manson arrived with a sword and slashed his face and ear. After that, Boussoleil stabbed Hinman to death, allegedly on Manson's instruction. One of the women used Hinman's blood to write "political piggy" on the wall and to draw a panther paw, the Black Panther symbol. This becomes important later, the fact that she wrote "political piggy" on the wall in his blood. Boussoleil was arrested on August 6, 1969, after he was caught driving Hinman's car. What fucking idiot. Police found the murder weapon in the tyre well. So that becomes important later on. Remember that they wrote "political piggy" in his blood on that wall. Mm-hmm. And one of the Manson family members, Boussoleil, has been arrested for it. So Hinman's been murdered. One of the Manson family members is under arrest. And the Tate murders are going to happen right after this.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So we're back. T. So this man Hinman has been murdered in his apartment. They've written political piggy on the wall in his blood, all on Charles Manson's orders.
Yeah.
And this man, Busaleo, a family member, has been arrested for the crime. So now we're on to the big one, the Tate murders, or the Tate Labianca murders, because I'll explain why later. But on the night of August the 8th, 1969, four members of the Manson family, Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Linda Kasabian, drove from the Spawn Ranch to Cielo Drive in Benedict Canyon, the home of Sharon Tate and her husband, film director Roman Polanski. Now, Roman Polanski was working in Europe on a film, so he wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
Tex Watson claims that Charles Manson had instructed him to go to the house and totally destroy everyone in it and do it as gruesome as you can. Manson told the women to do as Tex Watson instructed them. The occupants of the house at Cielo Drive that night were movie actress Sharon Tate, who was 8.5 months pregnant the time, her friend and former lover Jay Sebring, a noted celebrity hairstylist, Polanski's friend...
Oh, so was she cheating?
No, they're all mates. It was a little party.
Oh, former lover, sorry, you said.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Her friend and former lover Jay Sebring, a noted celebrity hairstylist, Polanski's friend Wojciech Frykowski, and Frykowski's girlfriend Abigail Folger, heiress to the Folgers coffee fortune. I assume Folgers must be a famous coffee brand.
I'm assuming so.
But she was heir to that fortune.
Go
so
on, girl.
That's four of them at this little soiree they're having. Also present on the property was William Garrettson, the caretaker, and his 18-year-old friend, Stephen Parent. Now, music producer Quincy Jones was a friend of Sebring who had planned to join them that evening but did not go. And what is a very interesting fact that I think... Do you know... we've talked in the past about those people that were like supposed to be on the plane 9/11 and they never went.
Yeah.
Famous actor Steve McQueen, huge Hollywood actor, you've probably heard of his name.
Uh-huh.
He was invited that evening and had every intention of going, but his current female companion convinced him to stay home.
Whoa.
Yeah. So if he
went, he would have died.
If he didn't think he was going to get his beak wet that night, he would have gone round to the party.
Damn.
Yeah, I know. It's mad. So Tex Watson and the three women arrived at Cielo Drive just past midnight on August 9th. Watson climbed a telephone pole near the entrance gate and cut the phone line to the house. The group backed their car to the bottom of the hill that led to the estate and walked back up to the house. They climbed a bushy embankment to the right of the gate and entered the grounds. Headlights approached them from within the property, and Tex ordered the women to lie in the bushes. He stepped out and ordered the approaching driver to halt. 18-year-old Stephen Parent had been visiting the property's caretaker, William Garrettson, who lived in the guest house. Tex pointed a .22 caliber revolver at Stephen Parent, who begged him not to hurt him, claiming that he would not say anything. Tex then lunged at Stephen with a knife, giving him a defensive slash wound on the palm of his hand that severed tendons and tore the boy's watch off of his wrist.
Oh, my God!
Yeah. But Tex then shot him 4 times in the chest and abdomen, killing him in the front seat of his coupe car. Tex Watson then ordered the women to help push the car further up the driveway.
Jesus Christ.
So that's victim number one, 18-year-old Stephen Parent. Not even a noted Hollywood person, just a friend of the caretaker.
Wrong place, wrong time.
Yep. Tex then cut the screen of a window, then told Kasabian to keep watch down by the gate. She walked over to Stephen Parent's car and waited. Tex Watson removed the screen, entered through the window, and led Susan Atkins and Patricia Krenwinkel in through the front door. He whispered to Atkins, which awoke, was Czech Frykowski, who was sleeping on the living room couch. Tex kicked him in the head. Frykowski asked him who he was and what he was doing there, and Tex Watson replied,
"I'm the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business."
Oh.
Yep.
Creepy, horrible, weird shit.
I know. On Tex's direction, Susan Atkins found the house's 3 other occupants with Krenwinkel's help and forced them into the living room. Tex began to tie Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring together by their necks with rope, which he had brought, then slung it over the living room ceiling beams. Jay Sebring protested against the murderer's rough treatment of the pregnant Sharon Tate, so Tex shot him.
Jesus. Yeah.
But that didn't kill Jay. He shot him once. Abigail Folger was taken momentarily back to her bedroom for her purse, and she gave the murderers $70. Tex then shot Jay again 7 times. All for saying, treat Sharon better, she's pregnant. Frykowski's hands had been bound with a towel, but he freed himself and began struggling with Susan Atkins, who stabbed at his legs with a knife. He fought his way out of the front door and onto the porch. Tex Watson, however, caught up with him, struck him over the head with his gun multiple times, stabbed him repeatedly, and shot him twice. Kasabian, the girl on lookout, heard horrifying sounds and moved toward the house from her position in the driveway. She told Susan Atkins that someone was coming in an attempt by herself to stop the murders.
Yeah.
So Kasabian, the lookout girl, was getting second thoughts. Inside the house, Abigail Folger escaped from Krenwinkel and fled out a bedroom door to the pool area. Krenwinkel pursued her and caught her on the front lawn, where she stabbed her and tackled her to the ground. Tex then helped finish her off. Both of them stabbed her 28 Jesus. Times.
Jesus Christ. See, what's the need?
Well,
what's the need in stabbing and shooting someone that many times?
Charles told him to make it as gruesome as possible.
Yeah, I guess so, fucking hell.
Yeah. Frykowski was struggling across the lawn, but Tex Watson continued to stab him, killing him. In total, Frykowski suffered 51 stab wounds.
That is disgusting. Mm-hmm.
And he had also been struck 13 times in the head with the butt of Tex's gun, so hard that it bent the barrel and broke off one side of the gun grip.
Fucking hell.
Yep. In the house, Sharon Tate pleaded to be allowed to live long enough to give birth and offered herself as a hostage in an attempt to save the life of her unborn child.
Oh, gosh.
Both Susan Atkins and Tex Watson stabbed Sharon 16 times, killing her. And what's even worse is after Sharon, I saw an interview with Susan Atkins from prison.
Yeah.
And after Sharon did her pleading and said, please, let me live long enough to give birth to my child. She said, why do you think I'd give a shit about your baby? And then that's when they stabbed her. Yeah. 16 times.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That is awful. Mm-hmm. Why isn't fucking Charles here?
Well, because he's the cult leader. It's all him pulling the strings. And obviously he likes...
So what, he gets a kick out of having control, but not witnessing it or doing it?
Yeah.
Right.
Although his involvement comes into play a bit later. But according to Tex, Charles Manson had told the women to leave a sign, something witchy. Susan Atkins wrote pig on the front door in Sharon Tate's blood.
Right,
now, Susan Atkins claims she wrote this to copycat the murder scene of Gary Hinman in order to try and get Manson family member Bobby Busileo out of jail, because he was in jail for that murder. So she was like, if I wrote pig in his blood at Sharon's house,
they know that somebody's still alive.
Yeah, and they'll get him out of prison. That was her plan.
Okay.
So this is why it's called the Tate-LaBianca murders and not just the Tate murders, because the following night, the same four murderers plus Charles Manson himself and Leslie Van Houten and Clem Grogan went for a drive. Manson was allegedly displeased with the panic and flight of the victims in the previous night's murders.
Right.
He told Kasabian to drive to a house at 3301 Waverly Drive in the Los Feliz section of Los Angeles. This was located next door to a home where Manson and family members had attended a party the previous year. The home belonged to supermarket executive Leno LaBianca and his wife, Rosemary, co-owner of a dress shop. So nowhere near as famous as like Sharon Tate and stuff, but yeah, a high up rich person in the mm-hmm. area. According to Susan Atkins and Kasabian, Manson disappeared up the driveway and returned to say that he had tied up the house's occupants. So it seems that he wasn't happy with the mess that was made with the last night. And it's
what,
clear,
as in it wasn't enough mess?
He didn't like that they all, I guess, like escaped from the house and the panic that was caused sort of thing.
Right.
So clearly he wants to get more involved in this one.
So he wants it, we basically wants all of his victims still within the homes.
I guess so, yeah, I suppose. Because, I mean, if it will be less loud, I assume.
Right. So he really wants, like, he wants like the perfect murder.
Yeah, yeah, sort of.
Jesus.
So Manson disappeared up the driveway, returned to say that he had tied up the house's occupants. Tex, Kremwinkel and Van Houten then went in. Tex Watson claims in his autobiography, that's another thing. Tex Watson wrote an autobiography and he's still in prison. I hope he's not seeing any money from that.
Well, yeah.
Like, where does the money go from that sort of thing?
Well, maybe, probably to the government, no?
I would hope so. So, Manson pointed out a sleeping man through the window and the two entered through the unlocked back door. Tex claims Manson roused the sleeping Leno LaBianca from the couch at gunpoint and had Watson bind his hands with a leather thong. Rosemary was brought into the living room from the bedroom and Tex covered the couple heads with pillowcases, which he bound in place with lamp cords. Manson left and Kremwinkel and Van Houten entered the house. Tex had complained to Manson earlier of the inadequacy of the previous night's weapons. Watson sent the women from the kitchen to the bedroom, where Rosemary LaBianca had been returned, while he went to the living room and began stabbing Leno LaBianca with a chrome-plated bayonet. That's like a knife type thing.
Yeah.
The first thrust went into his throat.
Ouch.
Tex heard a scuffle in the bedroom and went in there to discover Rosemary LaBianca keeping the women at bay by swinging the lamp tied to her neck.
Fucking
hell. So she
had
this lamp that they're tied around. She was swinging it, trying to keep them at bay. He stabbed her several times with the bayonet, then returned to the living room and resumed attacking Leno, whom he stabbed a total of 12 times.
How do they get all this information? Is this because the people they've told them?
Yeah, they've told them later on.
Oh
yeah.
My God.
A key one is this Kasabian girl.
Okay.
She gave away a lot of information.
But why? Was it to get off time or something?
Yeah, because she technically, in both of these, didn't do anything. She was just there. And so later on she was just there
watching. She didn't stab or kill anybody.
No, she didn't do any of the actual crime. She was just there on like lookout or whatever. And so later on, I come to this later, but... She basically... There was a deal made where if she testified, there's always a fucking deal made. She'd get immunity.
Yeah.
But anyway, Tex returned to the bedroom and found... Oh, wait, no. He carved the word war into LaBianca's abdomen. So on his he carved the word war.
Oh, that is vile.
Yeah. Tex returned to the bedroom and found... In my opinion... Tex and Susan, apart from obviously Charles, are the worst, most disgusting individuals in this
whole thing.
I've also seen interviews of Susan Atkins.
Because she sounds like a fucking bitch.
She is remorseless. Her eyes just look soulless. It's just...
She is literally the devil.
Yeah, yeah. So Van Houten stabbed her approximately 16 times in the back and the exposed buttocks. Van Houten claimed during trial that Rosemary LaBianca was already dead during the stabbing. Evidence showed that 41 of the stab wounds had in fact been inflicted post-mortem, so after she'd died.
Yeah.
So Tex then cleaned off the bayonet and showered, while Kremwinkel wrote Rise and Death to Pigs on the walls. And Helter Skelter on the refrigerator door, all in LaBianca's blood.
Oh, Helter Skelter.
Yeah, now, Helter Skelter, obviously, you know, it's that ride sort of thing at the end of the pier. It's also the name of a song on a Beatles album that came out very, very recently when these attacks happened. She gave Leno LaBianca 14 punch wounds with an ivory-handled carving fork, which she left jutting out of his stomach. She also planted a steak knife in his throat.
Oof.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Charles Manson drove the other three family members who had departed Spawn Ranch with him that evening to the Venice home of a Lebanese actor called Saladin Nadir. Manson left them there and drove back to Spawn Ranch, leaving them and the LaBianca killers to hitchhike home. According to Kasabian, Manson wanted his followers to murder Nadir in his apartment, but Kasabian claims she thwarted this murder by deliberately knocking on the wrong apartment door and waking a stranger.
Right. Mm.
The group abandoned the murder plan and left, but Susan Atkins shat on the stairwell on the way out.
That's so random.
So, you know, classic. So those are all the main
events.
Now, there is a number of which we can either do the trial first, or there is a number of unsolved murders that many people have
believed
thought
it's them,
that it's the Manson family. Do you want to do the investigation and trial first, or would you like to cover those and you can have a little guess as to whether you think it was them or not?
I think because we're on the topic, let's do the trial and then we'll end with the other things.
So the morning after the Tate murders, the Tate murders became national news on August 9th, 1969. Winifred Chapman, the Polanski's housekeeper, had discovered the murder scene when she arrived at work that morning. On August the 10th, LA sheriffs informed the LA Police Department assigned to the Tate case of the bloody writing at the Hinman House. So the sheriffs would be like, there's similar writing at the Hinman House. But detectives believed the Tate murders were a consequence of a drug transaction, so the Tate team initially ignored the fact that there was the same writing at both houses.
Right.
So just a nice little miscarriage of justice there. The Tate autopsies were underway before the LaBianca bodies were discovered.
Mm.
The LaBianca crime scene was discovered at about 10:30 p.m. on August 10th, 19 hours after the murders were committed. That's quite a while.
Just a bit.
15-year-old Frank Struthers, Rosemary LaBianca's son from a prior marriage, returned from a camping trip and was concerned to see all the window shades of his home drawn and his stepfather's speedboat still parked in the driveway. He called his older sister and her boyfriend. The boyfriend, Joe Dorgan, accompanied them into the house where they discovered the bodies. On August the 12th, 1969, the LAPD told the press it had ruled out any connection between the Tate and LaBianca murders. Bit quick to rule that out, I personally think, especially since there was bloody writing at both places.
Yeah.
I think that's very dumb.
Yeah.
On August 16th, the sheriff's office raided Spawn Ranch and arrested Manson and 25 others as suspects in a major auto theft ring that had been stealing Volkswagen Beetles and converting them into dune buggies. So they arrested all of them for a completely separate crime.
Uh-huh.
There had been people in the area that had been stealing cars and converting them into dune buggies and then selling them on.
Right.
And so they raided Spawn Ranch and arrested Manson and 25 others of his followers.
Yeah.
Weapons were seized, but as the search warrant had been misdated, the group was released a few days later, so they weren't in custody for long. In a report at the end of August, the LaBianca detectives noted a possible connection between the bloody writings at the LaBianca house and the singing group The Beatles' most recent album, because obviously they wrote Helter Skelter on the fridge. Now, from what I remember, I believe Helter Skelter is what Charles Manson named the race war that he thought was going to happen. He was like, he calls this race war the Helter Skelter, I believe.
Right, okay.
So, breakthrough in the case. So, still working separately from the Tate team, the LaBianca team checked the sheriff's office in mid-October about similar crimes. They learned of the Hinman case and the murderer, Bobby Boussalel, a member of the Manson family. They learned that Hinman's detectives spoke to Bobby's girlfriend, Kitty. She had been arrested a few days earlier with the members of the Manson family and that raid. These arrests for car thefts had taken place at desert ranches to which the family had moved. The raiders of the ranches had found stolen dune buggies and other vehicles and had arrested 24 people, including Charles Manson. A highway patrol officer found Manson hiding in a cabinet beneath a bathroom sink. The officers had no idea that the people that they were arrested were involved with the murders in Los Angeles. On December the 1st, 1969, acting on information from these sources, LAPD announced warrants for the arrests of Watson, Krenwinkel and Kasabian in the Tate case. The suspect's involvement in the LaBianca murders was also noted. Manson and Susan Atkins were already in custody because of the car thefts, so they didn't need a warrant out for their arrest. Tex Watson and Krenwinkel were already under arrest with authorities in Texas and Alabama, so they had fucking ran. And they've been picked up on notice from the LAPD. Kasabian voluntarily surrendered to authorities in New Hampshire on December 2nd. This Kasabian girl just seems like someone that was just pulled along for the ride. She's like, she's giving everything away. She's trying to stop the murders. As soon as there's a warrant out for arrest, she's like, all right.
Like, arrest me.
So we're now on to the trial. The big event.
Dun, dun, dun.
When I was researching this trial, because obviously we did an episode on like the Johnny and Amber trial. This is the craziest criminal trial I have ever heard about in my life. The stuff that happens in this courtroom is just so bizarre.
Really?
And I'm just so excited to hear your reaction, because some of the stuff there, I'm just like, what the fuck was going on in this trial courtroom? So the trial began on June 15th, 1970, so the next year. The prosecution's main witness was Kasabian, like I said, who, along with Manson, Susan Atkins and Krenwinkel, had been charged with 7 counts of murder and 1 of conspiracy to commit murder. I assume the Nadir guy they didn't kill. Since Kasabian, by all accounts, had not participated in the killings, she was granted immunity in exchange for testimony that detailed the nights of the crimes.
Damn.
After testifying, Kasabian went into hiding for the next 40 years.
Fucking hell.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Like, I don't blame her, to be fair.
Jesus. Like, much of a life for her.
Because Van Houten had participated only in the LaBianca killings, she was charged with 2 counts of murder and 1 of conspiracy.
Right.
Originally, Judge William Keane had reluctantly granted Manson permission to act as his own attorney.
What?
Because of Manson's... So Manson was like, I want to be my own lawyer. And the judge was like, okay.
But, good luck.
Yeah. But because of Manson's conduct, including violations of a gag order and submission of outlandish and nonsensical pretrial motions, the permission was withdrawn before the trial even started.
I bet.
Yeah.
As it should.
Manson then claimed prejudice against the judge, and the judge was replaced by Charles Older. So we got a new judge in just before it started.
Right.
On Friday, July 24th, the first day of testimony, Manson appeared in court with an X carved into his forehead.
Ouch.
Yeah, I know. He issued a statement that he was considered inadequate and incompetent to speak or defend himself. And he had X'd himself from the establishment's world.
He's actually fucking messed up in the head.
Absolute nutter. Yeah, I know. over the following... Here you go. Over the following weekend, the female defendants duplicated the mark on their own foreheads. Yep. As did most of the other family members within a day or so.
Jesus.
So they all
Christ.
Did it as well. Yeah. Years later, this isn't important, but years later, Manson then carved the X into a swastika. Because of course he did. But that was years and years and years later while he was in prison.
Right.
So at the moment, it's still just an X.
So I'm guessing when it was a scar, it would turn into a...
He was scarred up, but then later on when he was in prison, he made it a swastika because he's a nut. Right. The prosecution... Oh, I need to cough. There we go.
That wasn't a cough.
No, it was a burp, but don't say it too loud.
Just told the podcast.
The prosecution argued that the triggering of Helter Skelter was Manson's main motive. That's what I mean. He thought Helter Skelter was the race war.
Yeah.
And he wanted to incite this. The crime scene's Bloody Beatles song reference, written by Susan Atkins, and the writing of Pigs, was correlated with testimony about Manson predictions that the... So Manson predicted that the murders black people would commit at the outset of his Helter Skelter would involve the writing of Pigs on the Wall in victim's blood. So he was like... So one of his thoughts was, in fact, we have that written over the crime scenes. People will assume it's black people, that sort of thing.
Right.
So, you know, nice racist person there. So the defense argued that the writing on the walls was to copy that of the Hinman murder scene, not an apocalyptic race war. So, right. You okay. know, the whole get the other guy off thing. During the trial, family members loitered near the entrances and corridors of the courthouse. When the group established itself in a vigil on the sidewalk, some members wore sheathed hunting knives. So that's nice and threatening outside the courtroom.
Just a bit.
Each of them was easily identifiable by the X on their forehead.
Of course.
One day, some members of the Manson family wore robes to the trial and said that if Manson was convicted, they would set themselves on fire.
Oh my God.
Some family members attempted to dissuade witnesses from testifying. Witness Paul Watkins and Joanne Flynn were both threatened. Paul was badly burned in a suspicious fire in his van.
Jesus.
This is next one's a nutty one as well. So a former family member, Barbara Hoyt, who had overheard Susan Atkins describing the tape members to another family member called Ruth, agreed to accompany Ruth to Hawaii. There, Ruth allegedly gave Barbara a hamburger spiked with LSD.
Oh my God!
Yep. Found sprawled on a Honolulu curb in a drugged stupor, Barbara was taken to hospital. She identified herself as a Tate LaBianca trial witness.
Oh.
So they went to that effort. They're like, we'll fly you out to Honolulu, we'll drug you, we'll leave you on a curb.
Jesus.
You can't be a witness in the trial.
That's messed up.
I know. The things this family did, they're sick. Sick group of people. It's mental. On August the 4th, despite precautions taken by the court, Manson flashed the jury a Los Angeles Times front page whose headline was Manson guilty, Nixon declares. So basically what happened was President Nixon, in an interview while the trial was on, he was like, you all right there?
There's a fly.
Oh, right, I see. So, yeah, basically, during the trial, President Nixon said on TV once, he was like, I think Charles Manson is guilty.
Mm-hmm.
So the newspapers ran a headline that says, Manson guilty, Nixon declares. So Charles Manson snuck this newspaper in and he showed it to the jurors, which you're not supposed to do because that can help sway the jurors' opinion.
Yeah.
So they were like, what the fuck are you doing, Charles? And also, it would sway the opinion the wrong way because it says Charles guilty in the bloody headline. But anyway, when talked to by the judge, the jurors contended that the headline did not influence them. The next day, the female defendants stood up and said in unison that in light of Nixon's remark, there was no point in going on with the trial. God's sake.
Imagine. All right, yeah, do you know what? Forget it happened.
Stop it. President's orders. On October 5th, Manson was denied the court's permission to question a witness. Leaping over the defense table, Manson attempted to attack the judge.
Surely that is just enough.
I know. Wrestled to the ground by bailiffs, he was removed from the courtroom with the female defendants who had risen and begun chanting in Latin.
Oh, while Latin?
While he was attacking this guy. They're just there like, I'm Charlie. From then on, Judge Older began wearing a revolver under his robes. Like, fair enough.
Oh my God.
On November 16th, the prosecution rested its case. 3 days later, the defense stunned the court by resting as well. Shouting their disapproval, Atkins, Krenwinkel, and Van Houten demanded their right to testify. Now, this is where it gets interesting, right?
Sam, it gets more interesting than that?
Yeah, I know. So basically, they rested their case, both sets of lawyers, and so the three women...
Could you also, for a second, could you imagine being Charles's lawyer and acting like... Yeah, he didn't do it.
Yeah, I know.
That's messed
That's
up.
That's why I could never be a lawyer for someone in a cold-blooded murder.
I don't know how they do it.
Yeah, I know. But so, yeah, so both sets of lawyers rest their case. And then the three women that are accused jump up and be like, no, I want to testify. I want to say something, basically.
Right.
And so then obviously the lawyers were like, whoa, wait a second. And the women's lawyers told the judge that their clients wanted to testify that they had planned and committed the crimes and that Manson had not been involved.
Whoa.
So basically the women were like, we don't want Manson to go to jail. We will testify. We'll say that he didn't plan it. It was just us.
Why?
I know. They were that obsessed with this man.
That is fucking I know. Mad.
And, yeah, by resting their case, the defense lawyers had tried to stop this. That's in even the people defending
Manson.
Yeah,
they knew what was going on.
Were like, we need to stop it.
Yeah.
So the prosecutor's view, it was... So the prosecutors thought that Manson was advising the women to testify in this way as a means to save himself.
Right.
I kind of think that it was half that, and it was half that the obsession. Women were obsessed and were actually up to doing it. So the next day, Manson testified on his own. He said some of this, I've got quotes of what he said. Some of it was very weird. He said, "These children that come at you with knives, they are your children. You taught them. I didn't teach them. I just tried to help them stand up. Most of the people at the ranch that you call the family were just people that you did not want." He also said, "I know this, that in your hearts and your souls, you're as much responsible for the Vietnam War as I am for killing these people."
What?
The Vietnam War was happening at the same time.
Right.
So
still, but like...
Yeah. "I can't judge any of you. I have no malice against you and no ribbons for you, but I think that it's high time that you all start looking at yourselves and judging the lie that you live in." He also said, "My father is the jailhouse. My father is your system. I am only what you made me. I am only a reflection of you. You want to kill me? Ha! I am already dead. Have been all my life. I've spent 23 years in tombs that you have built."
What the fuck?
He's such a little self-righteous ass, isn't he? He spoke for more than an hour. He said, among other things, that the music is telling the youth to rise up against the establishment. He said, "Why blame it on me? I didn't write the music."
What a freak!
Like, yeah, he's like, "The music did it, and I didn't write it."
The music made me pick up that knife. What a fucking freak.
He's such a dick. "To be honest with you," and then he was like, "To be honest with you, I don't recall ever saying, 'Get a knife and a change of clothes and go and do what Tex says.'" He's like, "Okay, thanks.
Of course
mate.
You're going to say that."
Yeah. As the trial... This is one is really fucking interesting.
Oh my god, it gets worse.
Oh, I told you, this is a fucking messed up trial. So, Van Houten, the one that only did the two murders, the LaBianca ones, that girl, her defense attorney was a guy called Hughes. As the trial concluded, defense attorney Hughes disappeared during a weekend trip. When the trial resumed with a different attorney representing Van Houten, the defendants were banned from the courtroom for the remainder of the guilty phase as they were trying to disrupt the proceedings. So why did one of the lawyers just disappear as the trial was wrapping up? We get to that later.
Okay.
On the suspected people.
No also, way!
Yes, it's very interesting. On January 25th, 1971, the jury returned guilty verdicts against the four defendants on each of the 27 separate counts against them. Midway through the penalty phase, Manson shaved his head and trimmed his beard to a fork. He told the press, "I am the devil, and the devil always has a bald head." The female defendants refrained from shaving their heads until the jurors retired to weigh the request of the death penalty. So they did still shave their heads. They just waited until like the last day.
Yeah.
On March 29th, 1971, the jury returned verdicts of death against all four defendants on all counts. On April 19th, 1971, Judge Older sentenced the four to death.
That is so good that they got the death penalty.
Yes, well... Hold that thought.
Oh, fuck's sake.
So we're on the aftermath now. So Tex Watson was not a part of that trial. As you know, it was Manson and then the three girls.
Yeah.
Or four girls. Three girls. Tex Watson returned to McKinney, Texas after the Tate LaBianca murders. He was arrested in Texas on November 30th, 1969. Watson fought being sent to California long enough that he was not included among the three defendants charged with Manson, so he wasn't part of that trial. His trial commenced in August 1971. By October, he too had been found guilty on 7 counts of murder and 1 count of conspiracy. Unlike the others, Tex Watson presented a psychiatric defense. Prosecutors made short work of Watson's insanity claims. So he was like, "I'm crazy." And they were like, "Nah, no you're not." Like his co-conspirators, Watson was sentenced to death. In February 1970, here we go. In February 1972, the death sentences of all five parties were automatically reduced to life in prison as the death penalty was abolished in California.
No!
I know.
Move them to a different state!
Yeah, I know, exactly. After his return to prison, Charles Manson's rhetoric and hippie speeches held little sway. He found temporary acceptance from the Aryan Brotherhood, who were a prison gang. His role was submissive to a sexually aggressive member of the group.
Why in California did they get rid of the death penalty?
There was another trial that has sorted that, but it was too long.
Yeah, I know, because they killed someone that wasn't...
Something like that.
Yeah. But why just in California? Like, why not?
Well, each state has different laws.
I know it does, but...
It's kind of like Scotland, England and
They should have just waited until after those people were killed.
They should have done,
For
yeah.
For sake.
Or they should have had a...
This is really controversial because not everyone believes in the death penalty.
They should have had a everyone that's on death row, you'll still be killed.
Yeah,
from now.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was interesting, but I think you might not have heard it, was that he became a submissive to a sexually aggressive member of a prison at San Quentin. Charles Manson.
Oh.
So he just became this guy's bitch in prison.
Oh my God.
Yeah, well, well deserved.
Yeah, to be fair, I didn't think it was possible.
Yeah. In a 1971 trial that took place after his Tate LaBianca convictions, Manson was found guilty of the murders of Gary Hinman, that guy, and also a person called Donald Shay. He was given another life sentence. Now, Donald Shay was a Spahn Ranch stuntman and a horse wrangler who had been killed approximately 10 days before the August 16th police raid on the ranch. Manson suspected that Shay was trying to get the family off of the ranch, so he killed him. On September the 5th, 1975, the Manson family returned to national attention when Screeky Fromm, she was a member of the Manson family, attempted to assassinate President Gerald Ford. On December 1987, Screeky Fromm, serving a life prison sentence, escaped briefly from a federal prison camp. She was trying to reach Manson because she heard he had testicular cancer. She was released on parole in 2009. How obsessed with someone can you be? You know, I'm going to escape prison because I've heard he's got ball cancer. Ridiculous. Yeah. So... Where are they now? So, Susan Atkins began suffering from brain cancer in 2008. An application for compassionate release based on her health was denied that same year. Susan died of natural causes in prison in September 2009. Patricia Krenwinkel remains in prison. She's still alive. Krenwinkel is now the longest serving female inmate in the California prison system. She has been denied parole 14 times, most recently in 2017. Leslie Van Houten, when she was convicted to the death sentence in 1971 at the age of 21, Van Houten became the youngest woman ever put on California's death row. Hello, PlayStation. Currently incarcerated, she has been denied parole 22 times.
Oof.
Tex Watson, he is still alive. He remains incarcerated. He has been denied parole 17 times, most recently in 2021. Whilst in prison, Watson claims to have become a born-again Christian.
These guys must be really fucking old by now.
Oh, they are. Yeah, they're in their 70s.
They're on the way out anyway.
Yeah. Charles Manson died of a heart attack and complications from colon cancer on November 19th, 2017.
Oh, what a shame.
He was 83 years old. This bit is something that I find interesting. He has spent all but 13 years of his life in some sort of supervised setting, be it prison or boys' home. Because remember, he stayed in that reform school. So he basically had this 13-year window where he was out in the real world. He spent his childhood in a boarding school and then the rest of his life in a prison.
Jesus.
That's mad to me.
That is crazy.
Yeah.
Considering he lived to 83, that means 70 years of his life.
Yeah.
Whew.
Yeah. So... I've got a couple of bits left. This is going to be a slightly longer podcast, but it's cool. We're all having fun. So the suspected further murders. So this could be more stuff that the Manson family did. Now, there are a number of other strange and brutal deaths that have been linked to both Charles Manson and members of his family. In fact, the LAPD believes that the family could have claimed up to at least 12 more victims. Cliff Shepherd, a former LAPD detective, said that Manson repeatedly claimed to have killed many others. And that you know, I said I heard an interview with Susan Watkins.
Yeah,
there was one bit where someone asked her a question, and it was really telling. They asked her. They said, "What was it like murdering those people?" And she went, "That night," and then continued with her answer. Yeah, so it's like it's clear that she's killed more people.
Oh my god!
Yeah, yeah. Prosecutor Stephen Kay once stated, "I know that Manson once told one of his cellmates that he was responsible for 35 murders." Deborah Tate, Sharon Tate's younger sister, has also claimed that investigators are just scraping the surface when it comes to the number of Manson's victims, and has further elaborated on how Manson sent her a taunting map of the Panamint Range with crosses on it that she believed meant to represent buried bodies. This has resulted in several excavations that have been undertaken, but have not resulted in any bodies being found. So, here are some possible murders and crimes committed by the Manson family. This isn't all of them, I just picked some interesting ones.
Yeah.
Nancy Warren, 64, and Clyda Delaney, 24, were both found near Ukiah, California, at the antique store owned by Nancy on October 13th, 1938. So this was years before the Tate murders. 1968, I think I meant to say, not 38. That would have been bloody years ago.
Yeah.
Clyda was 8 months pregnant. Nancy was her grandmother. They had both been beaten to death and strangled with 36 leather thongs. After the family were arrested, they became suspects in the...
Thongs?
Yeah, I don't know what that means. I just saw it on all the things. Leather thongs. Is that like leather underwear?
Surely that has a different meaning.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll find out.
Yeah.
After the family were arrested, they became suspects in the crime. Besides the similarities between this murder and the Manson family crime scenes, the authorities knew that members of the family had been in the Ukiah area at the time of the murders. Another similarity was that leather thongs were also used in the LaBianca murders. Yeah, no one in the family was ever charged with the murders, and no arrests were ever made in the case. Quickly, T, do you think they did it?
Yeah.
Cool. 1 point to the Manson family. That doesn't sound good,
they
does
want
it?
Points.
The next one is Darren Maul Scott. He was 64 years old. He was the uncle of Charles Manson and the brother of Manson's father. On May 27th, 1969... Oh, yeah, this is one I definitely think he did.
Well, yeah, if it's like, already connected to the family, yeah. It just makes sense.
On May 27th, 1969, this was a few months before the Tate murders, Scott was found brutally stabbed to death in his Kentucky apartment. His body was pinned to the kitchen floor with a butcher knife.
Oof.
And he had been stabbed 19 times.
Oof.
After Manson's arrest for the Tate/LaBianca murders, it was reported that residents claimed to have seen a man resembling Manson in the area at the time of the murder. Manson was on parole in California at the time of the murder, but the murder occurred when Manson was out of touch with his parole officers.
Absolutely.
Yep, I 100% think he did that one. Mark Waltz, 16 years old.
That's too young.
An acquaintance of the family's members and was even known to associate with them on Spawn Ranch. On July 17th, 1969, Waltz hitchhiked to Santa Monica Pier so he could go fishing. His fishing pole was found abandoned at the pier and his body was found the next day near Mulholland Drive, a very famous street in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
His face has been brutally bludgeoned and he had been shot 3 times in the chest. Though the family were reportedly shocked by his murder, Waltz's brother was convinced that Manson was responsible for his death.
Mm.
No links from Spawn Ranch were ever found. We've got John Philip Hort, his name was. This guy was 22. He met Manson in the summer of 1969. He joined the Manson family and was amongst the group that was arrested in the October raid of the ranch for the Tate-LaBianca murders. Manson suspected that this guy was an informant for the police. He thought that he was like a snitch, right? On November the 5th, 1969, Hort was associating with some members of the family. According to all other members of the family present, Hort suddenly found a gun in the room, picked it up, and promptly shot himself while attempting a game of Russian roulette. Do you know what that is?
I've heard of it, but...
Russian roulette is this game where you get a revolver gun. They have like 6 bullet things in it. You put 1 bullet in, spin the barrel.
Oh, you spin it and see where... Okay.
So they claimed that he suddenly found a gun in the room, picked it up and promptly shot himself while attempting a game of Russian roulette.
Interesting.
However, when police investigated the death, they found that the gun, rather than having zero bullets and one spent shell, instead contained seven bullets and one spent shell.
Oh.
So clearly, he wasn't playing Russian roulette.
Oh.
Moreover, the gun had been wiped free of fingerprints. Despite this, police concluded that Hort killed himself. Additionally, a male witness who had held Hort's head after the shooting told police he had entered the room to find a female Manson follower with the gun in her hand.
Right. To be fair, it just—they've done all of these, haven't they?
I think so. Yeah.
It's just—it would be too. It just—it's all connected somehow. They're connected to them somehow. It doesn't make sense that they wouldn't have done it.
We've got two left. Joel Pugh, 29. He was found dead. This one's interesting. He was found dead in the Talgarth Hotel in London, England.
Oh.
On December 1st, 1969, his wrists had been cut and his throat slit twice.
Oof.
Now, why would this guy in London be possibly a Manson murder? Well, British police listed the death as a drug-induced suicide, saying Pugh had been depressed. Pugh was a Manson family member who was married to another member, Sandra Good. Apparently, Manson hated this guy. He had no, someone said he had no reason to commit suicide, and Manson was very unhappy that Sandy was with Pugh, Stephen Kay, a family member, had said. Pugh's death occurred when a number of the Manson family members were being arrested for the Tate murders. Manson follower and apparently right-hand man, Bruce M. Davies, was in London at the time Pugh died.
Right.
Case closed, I think.
Case is closed on that one.
Last one. Oh, this was the guy, you know, the attorney that went missing.
Oh, yes.
At the end of the trial.
I'm interested.
Ronald Hughes, 35, was an American attorney who represented Leslie Van Houten, mm-hmm. a member of the Manson family. Hughes disappeared while on a camping trip during a 10-day recess from the Tate-LaBianca murder trial in November 1970. His body was found in March 1971 on the day the verdicts recommending the death penalty were returned for four Manson family members. It was rumoured that Hughes had been murdered by the family, possibly because he stood up to Manson.
Oof.
The last thing Manson said to Hughes was, "I don't want to see you in the courtroom again." And Hughes was never
seen again.
Family member Sandra Good stated that Hughes was the first of the retaliation murders.
Why the fuck didn't they look into these? Like, these literally mm-hmm. are so obvious. They're not coincidences.
I know. There is a conspiracy theory regarding Charles Manson, which I have written notes up, but we're going to move that into the next episode of the podcast. So, what do you think after all of that?
They are just disgusting, cold-blooded people.
It's mental, isn't it? I would be interested. I know that Billy's partner, Katie, has sent me some stuff on cults before, and I find them very interesting.
Maybe we'll do an episode on
just
cults.
How people can get so mesmerised by just one person. Like, it's mental.
It's like if you have an addictive personality, it's kind of like that. Like, when you easily get, like, persuaded.
I definitely would have preferred it to have gone down how it did in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh yeah, of course you would have.
Leonardo
done.
DiCaprio getting a flamethrower to them instead. That would have been much better.
Yeah.
That's why I think one thing that I just want to quickly talk about before we end this is, like, you know that Jeffrey Dahmer Netflix series that was really popular?
Yeah.
Everyone was watching, everyone was obsessed, and, like, they didn't ask the victims' families if, like, you know, they could be represented in it and stuff, which is why I don't watch it and it leaves a bad taste in my mouth.
Uh-huh.
I don't like some of these serial killer shows. I don't mind documentaries, but these shows that, like, glamorize it and have, like, a famous actor playing the murderer and stuff puts a bad taste in my mouth. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I like how they did it because it gives a happy... Yeah, it's not true, but it gives a happy ending to the victims. It makes the murderers look, like, absolutely pathetic. And then after that, if you want to look up and find out what actually happened, you can.
Yeah,
you can
do that's
it on your
true.
Own time. And I think that's the best way to do it. If you're going to do a Hollywood drama or glamorization, I like how that it's done that way.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So if anyone's not seen it, I recommend watching it. But we hope you guys enjoyed hearing about Charles Manson and the family. We're going to get into the conspiracy theory regarding him in a later episode. So stay tuned for that. If you want to send me other topics you want us to talk about, send us a message on Instagram @CourtCasePodcast. And we're going to see you next week, guys.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.